Welcome into another edition of the Dan and Victory Podcast, only on MusketeerReport.com. I'm Rick. He's Dan. Dan, edition number 24 of the Dan and Victory Podcast, and we've got a special guest in with us.
That's true. So number 24, obviously we have to go with the little fellow with the big ticker, as Bill Raftery once called him, former ex-point guard, owner of the most infamous teardrop jumper, I guess, in Xavier message board history.
Without and question.
Occasional deliverer of objections to the clientele at certain local establishments. I'm referring, of course, to Mr. Drew Lavender.
Well, and of course, I was referring to Mr. Brian Snow, who you heard laughing there in the background, national scout analyst, joining us for the podcast, as he's done a couple times already. He needs no introduction at MusketeerReport.com. Dan, lots to talk about in this edition.
Oh, hold on. Before we get going on that, whenever you bring up Andrew Philip Lavender, favorite moment in his career, it's New Year's Eve. They're playing Kansas State. Everyone called him the Beast. Why Drew decided to call himself the Beast, we have no idea. But he had his own Beast voice, and he just called himself the Beast. He walks out onto the court against Kansas State, stares to me and Dustin Dow and goes, "I'm guarding Beasley. I don't want no help. I'm the Beast." And just goes off his pregame routine. And it was like, where the heck did that come from?
I was at that game, by the way. Beasley only scored 4 points, but I don't think Lavender was the one guarding him.
No, that was Stan Burrell for part of that game, wasn't it?
No, it was Love and Love and I think Duncan, believe it or not.
Ah, GCL South guy, Dan. Moeller guy, Dan. Nice.
Yeah.
Watch your language on the podcast, Brawring. Hey, we don't mention the M-word.
Hey, I don't like it any more than you do, but this guy's all about it, so.
We're going to get a little later to a discussion of why college basketball is kind of ugly these days, and so bringing up GCL basketball may be appropriate. So it's been about 2 weeks since our last podcast. We apologize for the lack of an edition last week. We'll stick to our usual schedule from here on out this season. Musketeers suffered a pretty devastating set of home league losses with a nice non-conference win over Memphis sandwiched between them. Xavier currently sits at 16-12, 8-6 in the A-10. Unfortunately, we had talked about the last time around that X was in position to get into position to quote Bobby Knight from the Season on the Brink book, but they couldn't take advantage of those opportunities. So we'll talk a little bit more about the implications for the remainder of the season. But the big news over the last 2 weeks or so has been off the court rumblings. And I think what we want to hit on first, Rick and Brian, is that Xavier's search for a replacement for Mike Babinski as athletic director may be reaching its end.
Dan, on I guess it was either Saturday or Sunday whenever I got that, got word from a source that it sounds like Thor Bjorn will be the new athletic director. He's the current AD at Rhode Island. And I was told that they're getting close and it could be wrapped up as soon as this week. Now, technically, there were still a few names involved in the search that had not been finalized to them yet, which is why you haven't heard any type of announcement. But that sounds like it is going to be the pick. And I know Brian and others have heard the same. So I think that's a pretty solid chance at this point.
Question for both you guys. Do we know how Bjorn sort of got on XU's radar? Was it just through the A-10 connection, or is this a guy that maybe does this guy have any particular record that would have interested Xavier going through this search?
I would start off, I would say, like, obviously he's at a school where basketball's the show. So I think that was something Xavier was looking for. He knows what he's dealing with at Xavier. I guess he's kind of been involved with the new arena at Rhode Island. I don't know his exact timeline, but he's at least been there since it opened. My guess is Mike Babinski knew him. So I would say that's what kind of led to him, you know, being a candidate outside of him probably saying, "Hey, I'm interested." So that's where I think the starting point probably was.
And one thing that I think would, you know, his recent track record of hiring coaches. I mean, Hurley, I think most people would agree, is a pretty intriguing hire, and it remains to be seen how good of a hire it is, but I think most expect it to be a good one. And I think it also sort of falls in line with what Xavier's done well, and that's hiring young coaches on the way up and guys with some talent instead of hiring retread guys who have failed elsewhere.
I did a little bit of research on Bjorn's tenure at URI, and the two coaching decisions that I found interesting, and I unfortunately have lost the link, but he was instrumental in hiring a new football coach at URI. They have sort of small college football there. And he hired a gentleman who turned the program around in 2 years and actually ended up getting a pretty high position on the Miami Dolphins staff. I think he's their special teams coach now. So that was one that he got some plaudits for, I saw online in the Rhode Island fan community. Also, I believe it was during his tenure, as you say, that Rhode Island eased out Jim Barron and brought in the Hurley brothers. They're always sort of referred to as a tandem, which obviously was an exciting hire and I think really galvanized that fan base. And a lot of people are very excited about the direction that Rhode Island's basketball program is going now. So the other big issue we've been talking about a lot is conference realignment. It's been one of those processes that's moved really fast for short periods of time, and then we haven't heard any developments for a long period of time. But now it appears that things are starting to coalesce. At the end of last week, I think Brian reported, and it was confirmed a couple other places, Goodman on CBS, this Mark Blodgen, who's with USA Today, and now today there was a pretty extensive article by Brett McMurphy of ESPN, that the final separation of the so-called Catholic Seven from the football schools of the Big East will be finalized very soon. There are some financial issues yet to be resolved, but it sounds like, based on this, and this maybe can lead us into the first part of our discussion today, that a decision has been made about the conference name, the Big East name and brand, and the Madison Square Garden contract for the tournament. So if you guys can sort of weigh in on what you're hearing as far as those two big issues, which have been of primary importance since day one of these negotiations.
Yeah, I'll start off with what I know. And I use the term know basically in quotes because everything's subject to change. But Xavier and Butler will be in the Big East next year with the seven schools that are basketball only in the current Big East. The teams that play football in the current Big East will be in something not called the Big East next year. So that gives you nine schools for sure. There's a chance of a tenth. Some are saying Creighton's in. Some are saying Creighton's not in for next year. From what I was told is the plan as of late last week was to go with nine and go from there. But 10 is possible for sure. Xavier's in, Butler's in, and no, they haven't notified the A-10 that they're leaving for a conference that hasn't yet been formed yet. I know that's breaking news. So that's where things stand there. Good news for Xavier. They're going to, you know, pay the A-10 $2 million in exit fee, but they get $3, $4 million in the first year. And as McMurphy, and that's in TV money, and then as McMurphy reported today, all those Catholic schools that are in the current Big East, as they move to the new Big East, they are keeping their NCAA tournament credits. So there will be a pot of NCAA tournament credits already in. And I don't know how they'll split those up exactly from year to year. I imagine it'll just be a communist way of everyone gets it. And if so, that means Xavier will probably get exactly what they got in NCAA tournament revenue in the A-10. And that should go up as each year progresses.
Brian, how significant of an issue is the fact that the Catholic Seven, specifically those schools that have been earning NCAA credits, Marquette, Georgetown being the two that come to mind immediately, how significant is it that those schools are going to keep those NCAA credits? Because I think the last time we talked about this, you said that one of the obstacles that made this a little bit of a tough decision, maybe tough decision isn't, but a hard decision financially for Xavier was leaving those credits behind in the Atlantic 10.
Yeah, I mean, it's huge. It's multi-million dollars. I know people don't like to realize this, but college sports is nothing more than a big business, has been for 50 years, and it's not changing anytime soon. And what's the point of big business? To make money. So it's a multi-million dollar thing. It's that simple. It's key. It's important. It's huge. Now, granted, you know, those schools had to leave money on the table to UC, UConn, and South Florida to get those credits and to get the name and to get Madison Square Garden. But they got it. They're going to start next year. They'll be on Fox Sports 1, and they're going to get probably the best TV deal of any basketball school in the country.
Rick, can you tell us a little bit about your understanding of what the TV deal is looking like? I know there was a big announcement from News Corp, the parent company of Fox, today.
Well, yeah, Fox basically announced the summer launch of Fox Sports 1. I don't know the exact date that they're launching on, but it is going to be up for summer. And it's basically, I mean, from the programming that they're listing, it sounds like they're going head-to-head with ESPN and basically running similar news shows and talk shows throughout the day. They've got something with Regis Philbin on it. it sounds interesting. I mean, it's certainly going to probably change some things as far as the landscape on TV goes. I mean, you're going to see more networks, I think, go to this route and try to challenge ESPN a little bit because they've become so ridiculous over the years. So I think that's going to be interesting for years to come as far as how this network can grow with the new Big East. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. It looked like some of the other obviously they couldn't, as Brian said, this Big East entity doesn't really exist at this point. So that was not a selling point from today's discussion, but they did mention some of the other offerings that are going to be on this. And it's a pretty robust lineup that covers a lot of sports. They've got some Big 12 football and basketball. They've got some Pac-12 football and basketball. They're going to have, obviously, this Catholic 7 league. Well, it's going to be the Big East. I think they've got the UEFA Champions League. They've got the World Cup coming up as far as soccer. And then I think they're going to push some of their regional baseball coverage onto this Fox Sports 1 and potentially Fox Sports 2 when they get that going. And finally, I guess the interesting thing for me is that it looks like it's going to replace the Speed Channel, which I was shocked to learn has like 81 million subscribers in the United States, which is actually not that far off. It's only about 20% less in terms of market penetration as ESPN itself.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you have the Speed Channel if you're listening to this. You probably don't know you have it, but you have it. It's been packaged with a lot of the Fox Sports Channel, so everyone's got it. Now, the thing is I think I read where currently Fox gets 31 cents for the Speed Channel, and they're going to try to up that to as much as a dollar. And if, you know, I don't know if they can get a dollar, but let's say they get 75 cents. You start doing 40 cents a month times 80 million. That's a lot of money. So you can see where they've got the money to, make this investment if it goes as they plan.
Guys, one of the big issues that's been discussed, and Brian brought this up a little bit in his first statement on this point, was potential further expansion of this league. Can you guys give me an idea? First of all, there's been a lot of reports out there that it's a done deal that this league is going to expand to 12. That there may be disagreement about who those teams might be, but there seems to be, at least in the mainstream media reports on this, a consensus that this league is going to expand to 12 and that that's being driven by Fox's desire for more inventory.
Yeah, Fox.
Right. Right. Do you guys see that as being a priority? And if so, what's your understanding of the timeline for expansion into the Big East?
As far as I'm concerned and heard, I think the coaches, if you all ask them, they want it at 10. Fox seems to want it at 12. I think eventually it gets to 12. At least that's what I was told, is, you know, at one somehow, some way it'll get to 12. But I was told there's just no consensus on who they want after Xavier and Butler. Now, maybe Creighton gets that consensus. I know Marquette really wants Creighton in. So maybe that happens. But I'm told, like, you know, they think it's going to get to 12, but there's certainly no timeline. And the schools just aren't known at this point. There's just too much,
you know, indecision on the part of the schools with a vote. And, you know, when it happens, it happens. But I don't think there's anything firm set in stone yet. I mean, if there's been one thing that has been completely and utterly a mess in this whole thing from report to report, it's, you know, who's going to be in the league outside of Xavier and Butler. And Creighton seems to be pretty consistent, except for Feinstein's column, what, a month ago. And, you know, that seems to be where things stand, is there's just no consensus. And without a consensus, those teams aren't going to be added.
Yeah, I've been hearing the same.
Go ahead, Rick.
I've been hearing the same thing as Brian, as far as there is no consensus. And like he said, I mean, Marquette seems to be pushing a lot of this because of the situation that they sit in as kind of the top dog in this conference, money wise. So I think there is a good chance that Creighton gets in when they do expand, but I don't think there's any doubt that it gets to 12 teams. There's a reason that's being reported everywhere, and that's because Fox is putting it out there, and Fox is driving this, and they've got the money in all this. So I think it's going to get to 12 as soon as Fox wants it to get to 12. But I don't think it's going to be by next year, because they're just not going to come to a consensus by that time.
Well, here's the question that Xavier fans have been asking, and it's kind of been bizarre to me that it seemed like Xavier fans waited about 90 seconds after spent about 90 seconds celebrating that X was going to be involved in this new league, and then immediately turned the knives on their neighbors to the north and want to know if the University of Dayton is going to get an invitation. And here's from my uneducated survey of what seems to be out there. It seems like Marquette really wants to bring Creighton into the league. It seems like Georgetown would like to bring Richmond into the league. And then it seems like that 12th spot is kind of up for grabs between UD, SLU, and maybe some wild cards that might be out there. Is the wild-ass guess that I just shared, does it jibe with you guys' understanding of what's going on? And if you both can weigh in on Dayton's strengths and weaknesses vis-a-vis the Big East.
I think certainly, for the most part, that's what I've heard. You know, it's, you know, it seems that simple, but nothing's that simple. So, but yeah, I've heard Marquette likes Creighton. Georgetown likes Richmond. Richmond's an elite, elite academic school. So, you know, Georgetown's going to like that. Obviously, it's close for their sports. In terms of the 12th team, you look at Dayton and you look at St. Louis. Dayton's advantage is 13,000 seat arena that's always full. They actually get good TV numbers in the Dayton area. You know, the first fours there in the A-10 could plaster their logo at UD Arena. And you know, relatively successful program. You look at SLU, gorgeous 10,000-seat arena in a much bigger media market, but they're not the top dog in the media market. And, you know, they've had a pretty good run of it here the last couple years, so – so that's the, you know, what people are looking at, you know, SLU draws, but they don't draw like Dayton draws. So that's the question. I mean, there's a lot to, you know, I don't know that one school immediately jumps out as being the obvious choice over the other.
I think one thing we've been hearing that's consistent, both Brian and I have heard, that it's Xavier's not going to be – first of all, Xavier doesn't really have a say in this at this point. They're not even in the conference yet. But second of all, even when and if they're asked about this, I don't think Xavier's trying to help Dayton by any means get into this conference, as they may have done in the A-10.
Trying to help, I think that's being as political as humanly possible. I would say the moment Xavier has a vote, they don't want Dayton. And it's just common sense. Right. I don't think it's anything personal. It's – if a school was 45 minutes from you and is very similar to you in every way, you don't want them having the same advantage as you do. It's just obvious.
Right. And it seems like that would be, you know, one of the things that both of you guys have talked about in the past is that Xavier always fights this, has always fought their conference affiliation when they're recruiting kids. And we've seen examples. I mean, you can't always, as both of you have noted before, you can't always narrow it down to a kid specifically saying, I'm not going to Xavier because they're in the Atlantic 10. But if Xavier's in the Big East and Dayton is not, and UC is in the new Metro Conference or whatever, which is not going to have the brand of the Big East, Xavier all of a sudden is benefiting from that conference affiliation difference between those two schools. And in the Southwest Ohio area, you know, it's maybe it's not one of the top recruiting hotbeds in the country, but between Dayton and Cincinnati, there's been a fair amount of high major talent produced over the past decade. So certainly it would bear some fruit in the recruiting from a recruiting standpoint, it seems to me.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest deals with going to the new Big East is that, I mean, it does. And there's no better example than DSR. I mean, obviously that was dragged out forever on the site. I don't need to rehash that. But, I mean, that was very clearly a conference deal. That's why he chose Georgetown over Xavier. So I don't think it necessarily gets them in on a ton of new kids that they weren't recruiting before. I mean, there may be a kid here or there, like we've sort of seen with Jaquan Lyle already. But for the most part, I think it just – those couple of kids that are maybe top end of what Xavier's recruiting, maybe you just have a better chance with them because schools aren't able to use your conference against you anymore.
Yeah, I mean, like, Roddy Peters was going to go to Maryland the way it shook down. He was going to Maryland. But for the biggest thing that worked against Xavier, why he didn't commit maybe before Maryland put the pressure on, was he didn't like the conference. Now he can't say that. Now, obviously, not Roddy, but, you know, now a recruit in his position isn't going to say that.
Guys, I just want to get your comments on a couple other candidates that have been mooted for this league. One kind of intriguing subplot has been Notre Dame's situation. Another constant refrain I've heard is, well, why not VCU? And then I'm also curious to know if you guys think there are any other dark horses out there that might emerge over the next 12, 18 months as the Big East tries to coalesce around these 12 teams. I know Feinstein mentioned Siena, which seems like a long shot. But, I mean, are there any other schools that you think, if you can weigh in on Notre Dame and VCU, and then if there are any other schools out there you think might be potential additions that may not be on the radar screen right now?
First of all, Dan, you would know this based on the big words you're using and all that lawyering you have, but I think VCU, they're a public school. Then you get into like laws with books being opened and all that crap. Kind of the same reason that the West Coast Conference would not accept San Diego State when it looked like San Diego State was going to go to the Big East for football. Why it didn't want to take their basketball, even though obviously it would have been smart because San Diego State's public and the West Coast Conference is all small private religious schools. So I think that's really what's going to work against VCU. Also, VCU's academics are not spectacular. In terms of who was the other school? Sorry, I lost focus.
Notre Dame.
Yeah, just kind of watch them on TV. I don't see them doing it. I don't know that it makes sense for them. You know, they can join the Big 12 if they want. They can join the ACC if they want. They're going to get more money than they would in the Big East. So I just don't see that one happening in any way, shape, or form.
I could see Notre Dame possibly doing it for a year, though, Brian, because they have to wait until 2014 to go to the ACC, even if they wanted to do that, correct?
It sounds like they can get in next year.
Oh, okay. Well, then screw it. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about.
Well, that's obvious.
So any other schools out there, guys, I mean, that maybe you've heard mention of that might be candidates, or is it really down to – effectively four schools, Creighton, Dayton, St. Louis, and I'm leaving somebody out, Richmond, for three spots.
That's what I think it is, but, you know, that's kind of above my pay grade.
Yeah, I mean, there's no telling. These types of things always seem to change, but as of right now, those are definitely the schools that are being targeted. I mean, if they fall through or something changes, a new school arises, that could happen. But like Brian said, I mean, we're not going to know that at this point.
Okay, guys, I think that we had one or two other small issues to talk about on the conference situation. Okay, this may be a sort of a who gives a damn question, but assuming that this is the way forward, where does that leave the Atlantic 10, and what are some potential? I know, Rick, you talked to I think Brad Johansson about this issue. Maybe you can weigh in on how this might give your alma mater a chance to step up a few levels in the college basketball game.
Yeah, Dan, I think NKU needs to get in the A-10. I mean, I don't know if that's a realistic opportunity. NKU's definitely going to push for it. The biggest thing being that they need money, and they need TV money, and they're not getting any in the A-Sun. They're not on TV. They're not getting that exposure. The one thing that I think would make it really interesting for NKU is when you look around, you just sort of talked about the talent in like Ohio and just the Midwest in general. Yeah, there may not be a ton of elite talent right in the immediate, like sort of Cincinnati and Ohio area, but there is a ton of like second tier MAC talent and lower D1 talent. And, you know, it'd be pretty interesting for NKU because they go from being below all these MAC schools as things stand to. If they get into the A-10, they jump a lot of those schools as far as what they have to offer. They'd have one of the best facilities already in the conference, and I think a lot of people see them as a program on the rise. So could be very interesting, especially, you know, there's been rumors of a new head coach in the near future. So who knows? A lot of things going on there at NKU, but it'd definitely be interesting to see them get that shot.
So if we – I guess the next question, guys, if we want to go ahead and transition into a little discussion of the last three games for XU. As we mentioned, last Saturday, 23rd of February, Musketeers took on nationally ranked VCU at Cintas Center, Saturday afternoon game. The first half went about as well from a Xavier perspective as you could have hoped for, and then the roof caved in the second half. Rick, I know you were following the game closely. What was X doing in the other than the fact that VCU couldn't hit a 3-point goal in the first half to save their lives? They were 2 of 17. What was Xavier doing effectively in the first half to sort of keep VCU's fast-paced offense and defense off track?
Well, one of the biggest things, as we talked about all year, is this team plays really hard, and that's what they did to start this game. I mean, they came out ready to play. They were locked in on their assignment, and they knew they had to sprint baseline to baseline to get back on defense, and the bigs especially did that. They were in position every time. You know, there were no leakouts for easy buckets, and the biggest thing is they didn't turn the ball over early in the game, and the turnovers they did have weren't, you know, easy turnovers for layups, pick sixes, or if you will, that allow VCU to get in that press. And so that was the biggest thing, is just that VCU weren't able to hit shots because of Xavier's defense, and then Xavier didn't allow them easy opportunities in transition to get into their press. So there just wasn't a whole lot of opportunities for them to, you know, pressure Xavier and wreak that havoc. But the thing is, they did set the tone, because I will say they did a whole lot of fouling in the first half, VCU that is. And that kind of set the tone for when they turned things up in the second half.
So X led 31-20 at halftime. It was 39-26 at halftime. I was thinking of the Memphis halftime score. 39-26, 13-point lead at halftime. X had scored a couple baskets at the end with about as pretty a team basketball play as we've seen them all year. You know, Justin Martin came out in the first half like a house on fire. He had 8 points at the first TV timeout. D. Davis played, you know, he only got in 20 minutes, as we'll talk about later. But my goodness, he was having one of the best games of his season as far as I'm concerned. He ended up with 15 points in just 20 minutes of playing time. But in the second half, it looked to me, I don't have the X's and O's sort of scouting background that either of you guys do, but it looked to me like VCU changed some things up in their pressure, and Xavier just couldn't come to terms with it. It almost reminded me a little bit of what UC did at a halftime in the Crosstown Shootout when they started bringing the second defender up to really harass the Xavier ball handlers in the backcourt. What did you guys see as the turning point there? I mean, X was up 17 early in the second half, and then it felt like a switch was flipped.
Well, there's a few more things you got to talk about. First of all, they were like 14 of 20 in the first half, I think. I mean, they shot like seven. Xavier shot an incredible percentage in the first half of that game, I remember. And they obviously weren't going to keep that up in the second half, which, again, allowed more opportunities for VCU to get out in transition and get going. And that was the biggest difference in the second half, is that they were able to get into their press a lot more than they were in the first half. The other thing is, the biggest turning point, without a question, was when D. Davis went out of the game when he collided heads and got that concussion.
Yeah, I mean, without D, it was just, you know, they didn't have enough. They're one player short as it is against good teams, and that just made them short at the position you absolutely can't be short at against VCU.
And credit Troy Daniels, too, because he caught fire there in the second half, was making everything.
No question.
Yeah, he had back-to-back threes to cut the score from 17 to 11, and I thought that was absolutely critical for VCU because they were really looking a little bit at sea to start out the second half. I expected them to make a big run directly out of the locker room, and if anything, X came out those first 2 minutes, and it looked like a continuation of the first half. X was using transition effectively, it seemed to me. When they turned the ball over, it was because they were aggressive in transition. But when they turned the ball over, it was a travel or a ball thrown out of bounds that VCU couldn't turn it around and have a three on one at the other end. Yeah, Rick, you mentioned the hot shooting in the first half. Xavier 11 for 12 on 2-point goals in the first half. Yeah, that's not sustainable. But the interesting thing about it was is that most of those shots were pretty easy shots. The one thing about the Havoc defense is that if you can get it across half court, you got a pretty good chance at getting, as we saw in the second half, all that Xavier kept Xavier in the game was Brad Redford knocking down a bunch of threes and X getting some dunks and easy layups and free throw opportunities off of quick attacks to the basket.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't turn it over against them, you score. I mean, especially when they're not at home. They're a different team at home than they are on the road. But if you get it across half court, you score. I mean, that or you get a very good shot. That's just the nature of the beast.
Yeah, I mean, they overplay you so much that there's going to be opportunities on the back end of that pressure. And Xavier did a good job of finding that in the first half. And really, they did in the second half, too, when they were able to get the ball across half court against the pressure. The problem was, with D out of the game, and like I said, they set the tone in the first half with all that fouling they did, that it's like, at some point, the refs can't call everything. I'll say this, like, they got a lot away with a lot in the second half. I know fans agree 100% because I heard them all. But in this case, I'm usually not going to take your side when it comes to blaming the refs. But in this case, it wasn't necessarily blaming the refs, but what VCU did. They fouled so consistently throughout the game when they were going after balls that by the second half, I mean, you could see it. Guys were getting slapped all over the place, but it's like you can't call a foul on every single play of the game.
Hey, Rick, maybe the biggest two critical moments toward the end of that game. The first was the intentional foul called on Samaje Christen. The second was the charge called on Samaje Christen. The charging foul looked to me to be very questionable. It's the third time this season, joining, I believe, the Richmond game and the Wofford game that – actually, I'm wrong. It was the Charlotte game, not the Richmond game – that Samaje has been called for a charging foul in a 50-50 at best situation with a chance to either put Xavier ahead or to tie the game in the late going. I know we can get Brian started on his opinion of the application of the charge block rule, but I mean, is this something to be concerned about? Why is Samaje constantly getting seemingly victimized on these pretty brutal calls down the stretch?
Well, I'll say one. I wrote this after the game, and he's definitely not getting any star treatment yet from the officials, because you're right, he does not get any of the 50-50 calls on this. One thing I think, first of all, college refs just love the charge call in general. Two, teams know he can't shoot, and Xavier doesn't really have a whole lot of guys who can shoot, so they don't have to be super concerned about getting out on the perimeter to guard people. So it's a lot of guys sagging off in the lane, waiting to come from the weak side and take a charge on Samaje. And then three, sometimes I think your speed works against you a little bit, and the fact that he's not like a midget guard who's quick. He's a big, strong guy. Not necessarily strong, but he's a big physical guard who's quick, crashing or attacking the glass. So it looks a little more violent when he's running over defenders on his way to the rim.
Just stop calling friggin' charges. I don't get why friggin' referees have this obsession with calling a charge. First of all, 99% of them are flat blocks. It's just mind-numbing to me that these morons cannot figure out sliding over is not playing defense, first of all. So don't even get me going on that. I know Everco, oh, take a charge. No, guard your guy. Don't let him get by you. How about that? That's defense. And these refs, they just reward poor defense incessantly. It's mind-numbing. I want to punch every one of them in the face.
Word.
Well, first of all, it allows them to perform a dance in front of thousands of people. Just like Leslie Nielsen in The Naked Gun when he's impersonating the baseball umpire. It's a very flamboyant body motion, and it lets them be the center of attention, and you know they love that. Brian, I got a question for you. If they completely eliminated the charge from the game of basketball, would it ruin the game? Would it make it worse in any way?
It wouldn't be worse than what they're doing to it now with the block charge. The problem with the rule is it's just unenforceable.
Yeah, it's impossible to figure out.
Yeah, like, as far as I'm concerned, secondary defenders shouldn't be allowed to take charges because, to me, that's not playing defense. You are not entitled to a spot on the floor. You're entitled to guard your man. And when a secondary defender slides over, grabs his man region, and flops, that's not playing defense. That's being a parking cone.
Or if you're Zeller from Indiana grabbing someone else's man region and then pretending like you've been hit in your own, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's asinine, just the way we reward poor defense. Like, that's not defense. Guard your man. That's defense. And we reward it, and it's what it is, and it's turned into this monstrosity. I was watching the Illinois game tonight. And Kitts and Bo Borowski was the worst official in college basketball. They just made a just absolute abomination of officiating by feeling the need to call a charge. Call the friggin' block, because that's what it is.
Well, I think we'll revisit this issue a little bit later in the show. I want to move on, talk about the Memphis game. The Memphis game was one. If Xavier had held on to beat VCU, I felt like the Memphis game became an important game for Xavier because they still had maybe the tiniest shred of a hope of getting back in the at-large conversation, and at least it would look good for a potential NIT bid. But given the fact that X lost to VCU and then, of course, went on to lose to UMass, this game is – it's not particularly significant. But with that being said, X did a really nice job in this game. They came out super aggressive. They were up 31-20 at halftime, as I mistakenly said earlier. They went right at Shaq Goodwin from tip. Travis Taylor was all over the place in the first 5-6 minutes of the game. And the Musketeers really took it to the Tigers in the first half. They couldn't maintain that level in the second half, especially without D. Davis. They were so thin that they did let the Tigers back into the game as they started hitting everything they looked at there for a little while. But I was pretty impressed with X's effort against Memphis, and it was a good win, although certainly not, you know, as Rick mercifully probably didn't ask Chris Mack, it wasn't a pretty win, but
they don't have to. They don't need to. It doesn't need to say pretty in the win column, Dan. It doesn't. the one thing about this game was that first of all, I need to apologize to Samaje Kristen for not giving him the edge in the matchups article because Joe Jackson is so freaking average. His stats are so inflated by playing in Conference USA. There's no question Samaje is better than him. Second of all, this game was like literally the exact same game as the VCU game, other than Memphis just didn't care near as much as VCU did in the second half. Like, they were so nonchalant about the way they were coming back and still just making so many mental mistakes and then giving Xavier chances. And credit Xavier, they did make a few more plays down the stretch to win this one. But other than that, it was almost the exact same script as what we saw in the VCU game.
Yeah, like, as I put on Twitter, like, at halftime, my friend asked me, like, is Memphis missing one of their best players? Like, they didn't even look like a team. And then their comeback in the second half was contested 23-footers that went in. That was their comeback. I mean, it was stunning. It was like – and they're the most athletic team I've ever seen in my life up front. I mean, up close and personal, it's scary how athletic they are. They just – you know, they didn't feel like playing basketball. It wasn't very important to them.
Travis Taylor deserves a lot of credit in this game. He was a monster. I mean, especially the first half. He completely dominated Memphis's, like Brian said, bigger and more athletic players. He had some really nice post moves in this one, and even pulled out that mid-range jumper again. I mean, it was definitely one of Taylor's better performances this year.
No doubt. I mean, Isaiah Fillmore was really good. I mean, honestly, Samaje was just okay, and they beat Memphis. You know,
yeah, true.
D obviously didn't play. I mean, Justin Martin might as well have not played. It was
Jimmy Farr got a pair of rebounds.
Yeah, I mean, Jeff hits a big three. Brad, you know, Memphis apparently didn't realize that Brad Redford's a shooter.
Seriously, what was? Can we talk about that for a second? We have not seen since Brad's like first three games of his freshman year. We have not seen a team just literally not care where he is on the floor like Memphis did.
Xavier would set one flare screen that isn't even meant to get him a shot, and he'd be wide open, and he only shot it half the time because he was so confused as to why he was open.
It was
mind-numbing.
The one time in transition, I kid you not, he ran spaced out to one of the wings. No one covered him. So then he ran back through the baseline. Still no one was covering him. He came up on the opposite wing, was still wide open, then finally shot a wide-open three. But, like, they never looked for him in transition defense the entire time.
Yeah, I mean, apparently they felt, you know, it wasn't necessary to guard Brad. You know, I guess he's a driver on the scouting report. I'm not sure.
There were teams at Frankenmuth High School that played Frankenmuth High School that defended him, that had a better scouting report on him than Memphis did. Or maybe they had a scouting report and they just ignored it. I want to talk about Justin Martin, because Justin Martin threw the second worst pass in the history of college basketball at the end of that game. The worst one was the steal at the end of the Michael Jordan Georgetown game.
Yeah.
But I have never seen anything like that in my life.
Actually, I think, well, if you're only talking college, that's true. But that kid who was just on TV, the high school kids that just won the other night on like a three-quarter court shot.
Too.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a bad one.
Hold on. I want to say Xavier won that game by committing two of the single dumbest decisions in the history of mankind. Justin Martin's pass to Joe Jackson underneath the basket for a layup. Why he threw that, no one knows. And then Travis Taylor up three, fouling a guy when he catches it at the free throw line.
And not just fouling him, wrapping him up like it was timed, like they had to intentionally foul right there. Both arms around him.
And you're like, what is going on?
I mean, it was – well, first of all, and this is something we'll get back to when we talk about the Grantland article about some of the problems with college basketball. The last 4 minutes of this game, and I know this because I watched the replay on ESPN3 the next day because I couldn't believe my eyes. The last 4 minutes of this game took like 35 minutes to play. Because both teams were doing such unbelievably boneheaded things back and forth during those periods of time. And I, you know, while we're talking about the negatives from this game, Xavier 15 of 27 from the free throw line for 55%, which is bad. But Memphis shot 6 of 18, so it could have been worse. Memphis actually 8 of 18 from 3, 6 of 18 from the line, which leads me to wonder if maybe they shouldn't ask for a deviation from the rules that will let them just take jump shots from the top of the key instead of foul shots.
If there's one thing Xavier did well, is they fouled the right guys. They fouled Tariq Black and DJ Steffens. So they fouled the right guys, I think by accident, but nonetheless, that's what they did.
Well, so the Memphis game, sort of a moderately clownish 64-62 victory. The Musketeers were back in action Saturday afternoon against UMass. This was a incredibly important game for the Musketeers' chances of obtaining a first-round bye in the Atlantic 10 tournament. They already were a little bit behind the eight ball, having lost to Dayton and being on five conference losses. This 77-72 loss put paid to any chance of that happening. This was a game where the Musketeers had a chance to deliver a knockout blow early. They couldn't do it. And UMass hit a remarkable percentage from three in the second half, 9 of 14. And the Musketeers just didn't have the firepower to keep up.
Yeah, I mean, one was clear. Samaje didn't play great. He at least played hard. Isaiah Fillmore played really well. Travis Taylor did not. Justin Martin definitely did not. D. Davis was clearly not healthy. And while Brad Redford made a couple shots, he got absolutely fried on the defensive end. And, you know, Xavier can't have that. They need D. Davis to be D. Davis, and he just clearly wasn't right. I mean, there's no question about that. And they lost defensive assignments, and guys got open. And, you know, the key sequence in the game, Xavier's down three. He has a three-on-one break. D turns it over. Then he points to Samaje. You guard him. You know, in transition, D sinks to the lane to get someone else. Samaje either doesn't hear him, disregards it, whatever it may be, runs back down into the lane to get another guy. They leave, forget who it was, open for a three, hits a three. Memphis is up six, ball game.
Well, one thing about the Xavier team is they're never going to be able to outscore people, right? So when they get on a little roll and they start scoring a few points, it has to come while they're playing well on the defensive end and getting stops. And usually it's as a result of the way they're playing on defense. In this game, they never had that edge on the defensive end. Every time they'd get on a little bit of run, it was really because basically the tempo of the game just picked up and allowed UMass to play more their style and score easier on their end of the court. So, I mean, that was pretty much the story of this game, is Xavier just didn't quite have it at either end. And, you know, we keep talking about how big of a game this was for Xavier, but at the end of the day, if you're talking about you've got to get a bye in your conference to have a chance at winning your conference tournament, which you have to do just to get in the tournament, it's probably not as big of a game, or you don't have as much control over it as you would like. And UMass, who's still fighting for an at-large bid, really, this was a huge game for them to get a win on the road.
Yeah, no question.
One thing that was a little bit out of the ordinary is that X had a chance in the first half to get up double digits and to put UMass in a hole, largely because they got Chaz Williams in early foul trouble. He had three fouls at the 10-minute mark of the first half. And all that happened is that his running mate, Freddie Riley, hit six threes, and Trey Davis came off the bench and hit a couple threes in relief of him. I mean, UMass had the guard depth to – I mean, guys, I don't know – I would assume that those guys do not typically shoot at that level, but they had guard depth. They were able to bring guys off the bench that were able to do a job. And Xavier just, I mean, they just don't have any depth. And with D. Davis being as limited as he was in that game, you know, 1 for 6 from the field, he only played 18 minutes, turned the ball over three times. I mean, it was just an uphill battle. Not Travis Taylor's best night either. 10 points, 8 rebounds, but he turned the ball over 5 times.
Yep.
Really a forgettable game. And I thought, as far as I'm concerned, it was the worst defensive performance of the season for the Musketeers.
I agree 100% on the defensive thing. One thing we should point out, though, Isaiah Fillmore, this was really a third straight game that he's played really well in, with 14 points and 7 rebounds. It also marked the last 6 of the last 8 games he's been in double figures scoring wise. He's really kind of come on, maybe a little bit, playing more like the player we expected him to be earlier in the season. When I said I just didn't think he was quite physically ready or healthy enough yet.
Okay, and I wanted to, so that's last week's games. Musketeers with 2 more games remaining in the regular season. They are against they play probably the best team in the Atlantic 10 in St. Louis. That'll be Wednesday night. We'll probably post this on Wednesday, so you'll probably get this before 9 o'clock tip tomorrow. Obviously, St. Louis is just really good, deep team with a lot of guys that can shoot. They play really good defense. And then on Saturday, the Musketeers end the seasons, end the regular season sort of the way they began it by playing Butler, although this time at Hinkle Fieldhouse on Senior Day. Guys, do the Musketeers have really a prayer in either of these games, or is it a pretty long shot that the Muskies will get that 9th conference win?
Well, I think the SLU game is going to be really tough because that's just a bad matchup for X at individual positions, but mostly because Xavier has to win these scrappy, low-scoring, ugly games that they grind out in the half court, and that's kind of what SLU excels in. I mean, they execute really well in the half court and score the ball really well in that slower-paced game. They're just efficient offensively, so I think that's going to be a really tough matchup for them. The Butler game, I mean, you never know, but doing that on the road and the situation Butler's in right now, I can't see Xavier pulling that one off either.
I'll say this. If there's one thing the Xavier team has proven to us, they're going to be in the game with 4 minutes to go, and then whatever happens, happens. So that's just going to be the way it is.
Well, guys, let's move on to another topic. There's been, a lot of clamor around the game this year, both in the media, the blogosphere, some of the mainstream columnists, about the lack of scoring in college basketball. And Rick and I broached this issue on the last show, but there was a article by Shane Ryan on Grantland.com. It was posted last Thursday, I believe, where Ryan, who describes himself as a diehard college basketball fan who would watch whatever, but believes that but he states that college basketball is a sport in crisis. Nobody cares to watch. College basketball will never be football, but it doesn't have to be so gerundial form of a profanity. Dreadful. It doesn't have to become the slog that it's become over the last several years, and it doesn't have to become a sport whose popularity is limited to a few days in March. And he made three suggestions, and I thought two of them were good and one of them was stupid. The first one was to limit coaches to two timeouts per half rather than five in total, to take the game out of the to make the game a little bit less like football, and put the game more in the hands of the players instead of the coaches. The second proposal was to reduce the shot clock to the NBA length of 24 seconds to increase the number of possessions, drive up scoring, and encourage more up-tempo play. And the third one, which I thought was a stupid idea, was to put into place a few rule changes that would make it more difficult for teams to foul to make unintentional intentional fouls at the end of the game to try and close gaps at the very end. What are you guys – do you guys think college basketball is a sport in crisis? Do you think his criticisms are valid? And if so, what do you think of the suggestions that writer has presented?
First thing, TV money, higher than it's ever been in college basketball. Attendance, as good as it's ever been in college basketball, except for the bottom one-third, which has never drawn anybody anyway. Third, as much interest in media exposure, everyone's trying to get college basketball on their network. Where exactly is the problem? Am I missing something here?
I guess the issue is, the question is, do you think the game aesthetically from a – do you think that the quality of the game as you watch it is at a low compared to previous seasons?
Well, yeah, because there's just not very many good point guards in college basketball. That's the dirty little secret, is the point guard play the last 3 years in high school basketball has been a step above friggin' atrocious. And when that happens, it's not going to be good. That and the way the game's officiated, where you're allowed to tackle a guy as long as he doesn't have the ball in his hands, and sometimes even when he does. But don't worry, the moment a defender falls over, it's an offensive foul. That's going to limit scoring because you are literally allowed to play tackle basketball. That's the way the officials officiate. And then you combine that with bad point guard play, and that's going to lead to lower scoring. As far as the proposals, 24-second shot clock, that the players aren't good enough for a 24-second shot clock. You would see the worst shots you've ever seen in your life. The fouling at the end, he needs to shut up and never speak again. That said, the timeouts, he's absolutely – there's too many timeouts in basketball. You know, whether it's four total or two a half, I don't care. But five timeouts is just too many.
Well, here's the thing. I actually – despite the fact that I was shaking my head when you started talking, Brian, like I usually do, I actually agreed with most of what you said. I disagree that there's a problem. I do think there is a problem. I personally don't – I love college basketball. I love the product that it is right now. I agree with you that I don't think there's like people are going to stop watching it anytime soon. But I do think we're getting to a point, and it's getting so low scoring and so much like football, as you put it, which is, in my opinion, the biggest problem, that I don't think it's going to get any better. I think it's only going to get worse. Now, the two biggest problems, in my opinion, are exactly what you said, is – it's just too physical. I mean, you can't go through the lane without getting a forearm shiver. And we're not talking about you used to be able to hand check or touch your man a little bit. We're talking about getting jabbed with forearms to your chest or biceps as you're running across the lane. When you're in the post, you're getting a 250-pound guy pushing on you as hard as he can the entire time with a forearm and his thigh trying to move you off the block. I mean, it is too physical. I completely agree with that. The problem is I don't know how you fix it, because the next biggest problem is there are too many stoppages. So I agree with the timeouts 100%. The problem is to fix the game being physical, I think you have to call more fouls, and I definitely don't want to see more stoppages. So that creates another issue. Then the third is I think the sabermetrics era of basketball, if you will, is a big problem right now. I mean, the more information and the smarter we've gotten about the game and efficiencies and things like that, the tempo-free stats have changed the game. Coaches know how they can keep games close. They all take the safe route out. They control every possession. I mean, honestly, at the end of a game, when's the last time you saw three or four possessions run up and down the court?
Oh,
it's
you
a
never,
stoppage
never.
At every – there's either never. A foul, a timeout, or – some type of stoppage to go check a replay every single trip down the court.
With the KenPom stuff, the scouting now is so much better than it's ever been. Everybody knows what everybody does and what they don't do, what each player doesn't do well.
Right.
I mean, I know all the old people love to, oh, we used to play defense. They don't play defense. No, they play defense 100 times better. Put in an old tape of Byron Larkin's games. Teams barely knew he was left-handed. I mean, like, we are just so far in advance. The players are bigger, stronger, more athletic, and they have so much more knowledge. The coaches have so much more knowledge. The defenses are just so much better. These kids are just so good they're able to score.
By the way, this would probably be a good time. I don't think a lot of fans even know about this. Just so you know, the video program that all the coaches use in college basketball called Synergy, it when you watch the film on there, it also breaks down stats, right? So for every team, you can get what they do in every situation, whether it be a ball screen, a dribble handoff, a shot, you know, ball screen roller, ball screen handler, all that stuff. And then it's broken down for each player, how many points they scored in each scenario, what percentage they shoot off a dribble handoff versus a ball screen. All that stuff is broken down for them, so they don't even have to research that at this point. They already have all those numbers, and it's just a matter of, you know, watching some film and putting that into your scouting report.
I agree 100% with what Brian said about officiating. I think the amount of contact that's permitted in the game is excessive, and it's the biggest prime mover behind why. I think in some ways college basketball is kind of in a position where the NBA was during the high period of those completely unwatchable Knicks teams in the mid-90s. But the issue of stoppages, I think, is huge, because one of the things that attracts people to the game of basketball is the athleticism, but it's also the spontaneity. It's also the improvisation. It's also running the fast break. It's also players sort of – it's players playing off one another, a two-man game, whatever else. When you reduce the game to a possession-by-possession slog where the coaches are basically drawing up X's and O's like a football coach, you lose a lot of what makes the game of basketball fun. And
did you your inner Bill Walton?
Absolutely. And you know what? When Walton goes off on those tirades, I'm with him 100%. Absolutely. I agree with Walton's sort of theory of why basketball is great. And I think there's a guy who was on three of the most legendarily fun to watch teams of all time. Wooden's UCLA teams, the 70s Blazers and the 86 Celtics. I mean, I think he's a guy that knows. I think he's an authority on that subject. So, I mean, I think that that's the biggest issue. And I don't know how you do it, because as Brian said, the importance of the commercial money, the importance of the media, it does require a lot of stoppages. But I think you could lower the timeouts, and maybe you could just – I mean, this would be sacrilege to a lot of people, but make it 10-minute quarters and have a long quarter break where they could dump in two media timeouts worth of commercials so we can have more periods of actual basketball.
I don't even know if you need that as much, because I think if you actually got to see these guys run up and down the court for 8 possessions in a row – you'd be fine with them taking a break after that. You'd probably need it. It'd get sloppy. I mean, these dudes are flying up and down the court when it gets going in some of these games. So the thing is, we never see it, because there's never more than like 2 trips up back and forth before there's a foul, usually, or someone's taking a timeout or whatever.
Too many damn timeouts.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I know you guys every year probably end up — well, I know, Rick, you were at the regionals last year. I'm sure, Brian, you cover the NCAA tournament every year. I mean, those games, if you're a fan, I mean, it's being at the venue is awful. The games are like 3 hours long, yeah. And there's like you'll go through. I remember being at a first four game a couple years ago. It was Clemson, and I can't remember who they were playing, and Southern Cal or something like that. It may have been VCU actually, and it was just. There was one period where I remember talking to my dad. I'm like, there 15 minutes has elapsed and we've seen 90 seconds of basketball. And that wasn't even at the end of the game. So, I mean, I'm with you 100% as far as the stoppages go. And I'm really glad, Brian, that you compared my tirade there to Bill Walton, because that's not the first time I've been compared to Bill Walton in some of my tirades about the game.
Oh, I thought you were going to say for other reasons. I was like, yeah, holy. Was like,
wow, man. We're getting a little open in the podcast. Yeah.
All right, guys. I think we're pretty much at the end of our self-imposed limitation. The next time we're on, we'll do our little – you know, we had talked – or at least I had talked about maybe doing a topic of – who our favorite announcers are. I think I may have given mine away just then.
Well, just go. Who's your favorite announcer? Is it Bill Walton?
I like Ian Eagle as a play-by-play guy, and I like Walton on color. Yeah.
Snow, who's your favorite too?
I mean, I got to go Gus Johnson. And then I think the two best analysts are Jay Billis and Doris Burke.
Damn. Well, okay. You took literally my two color analysts that I was going to use, and obviously Gus Johnson would be my favorite play-by-play guy. I will say this: my next favorite color analyst is Dan Dockich for sure.
Do you guys think? Where do you guys stand on Raftery at this point? Has he gone down the Vital rabbit hole and become just a cartoon?
No, not yet. He's still funny. He's still funny.
I'm fine with Raftery.
I like him. I do like, as a three-man booth, him, McDonough, and Billis. I think they have a great rapport, and they do a lot of ball busting, which is always fun, especially when they're calling some unwatchable Pitt UC game in the 40s.
Yeah. They are quite humorous.
I can't take Raftery without Billis, but with Billis, he's great. I think he's still funny.
So those are our booths. Maybe you guys can – maybe the posters on the message board can weigh in on the thread.
Yeah, well,
Rick, open that Rick up. any other business tonight either one of you want to bring up before we bring episode 24 to an end?
I'm good, and I know Snow doesn't have anything intelligent to add, so I guess that does it for the 24th Drew Lavender edition of the Dana Victory Podcast, only on MusketeerReport.com. For Brian and Dan, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.